This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Abraham Lincoln said that a house divided against itself cannot stand.
The question is on the adoption of the resolution. Those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no.
So what might it mean that all but two House Democrats voted for the impeachment inquiry into President Trump, and every Republican voted against it? We'll break down the inquiry along with the rest of the nation's top stories. And joining us here in studio to help with that is Anita Kumar, Politico's White House correspondent. Anita, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thanks for having me.
Aswin Subsang is White House reporter for The Daily Beast. Swin, welcome.
Always a pleasure.
And Byron York, chief political correspondent for The Washington Examiner. Byron, welcome.
Good to be here.
And of course, impeachment is where we need to start the hour, because yesterday the House voted, right along party lines, as we said, to formally open an impeachment inquiry into President Trump's dealings with Ukraine. Here is House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff, followed by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, as they spoke ahead of the vote yesterday morning.
This resolution sets the stage for the next phase of our investigation, one in which the American people will have the opportunity to hear from the witnesses firsthand.
Sadly, this is not any cause for any glee or comfort. This is something that is very solemn, that is something prayerful, and that we had to gather so much information to take us to this next step.
Now, the resolution passed 231 to 196. Every Republican and two Democrats voted against it. House Minority Whip Steve Scalise of Louisiana was one of the vocal opponents.
When you look through this resolution in multiple places, it gives veto authority by the chair to literally reject any witness that's brought forward by the minority. So no rights for the minority unless the chair so designates. In fact, in this resolution, it allows the chair to veto even the ability for the president to have legal counsel in the room. If the chair chooses at his whim, they can literally kick out the president's legal counsel. This is unprecedented. It's not only unprecedented, this is Soviet-style rules.
Anita Kumar, let's back up from the political rhetoric for a minute. Explain exactly what this vote was and what it did.
This vote is a process vote. So the House Democrats are still going to investigate the president. The impeachment inquiry continues. What it will do was sort of set the parameters on how this was going to go forward. So in a week's time, things will be public. So everything's been behind closed doors. The biggest part of this is that the American people are going to see this. But it also sets the parameters on how many minutes the questions can be, and who can ask and how they can ask. It also sets the parameters for the president, how he can defend himself. So it was not unexpected, but kind of a big move, because we're going to see this all take place now on television where we haven't seen that before.
And when we say things will be public, Anita, that doesn't necessarily mean everything that has been behind closed doors will now be made public.
No, but the House Democrats do want to release some of the documents and some more information. Obviously, we've seen a lot of leaks come out, so we know sort of what's happened, but we don't know everything that's happened. Some of these depositions, testimonies that they've had the last few weeks have been 8-10 hours long. So we're getting just a fraction of that information. So we'll start to see things in about a week's time, and I think that will really shift it. It'll give us a lot more public scrutiny than it's had.
Byron, I'd love to get your sense of this mostly party line vote. Republicans have been complaining about the closed door hearings for weeks, though it should be noted that there are some GOP members on the committees that are questioning witnesses that have been included in the hearings. But they've also been asking for this process to be much more public than it has been so far. It seemed like there was almost no way for this vote to go but straight down party lines.
Exactly. I get the sense that the sides are hardening on this. You see it in the polls, in which Americans are split almost 50-50 on this. And you see it on Capitol Hill. And I think we've gotten news in the last day or so that Democrats seem to believe they've pretty much gotten what they can get on this Ukraine investigation from these depositions that Anita was talking about. And basically what they want to do now They've got a few more to do, but they want to get their handful of most effective anti-Trump witnesses and build a TV show around them, put them on television and have them tell their story. This is precisely what they said after the release of the Mueller report. They said, well, people don't really understand this. If we make an effective presentation on television, there'll be maybe a Watergate moment and it'll be great. But it really appears, I mean, to me, it's World Series week. This is like a baseball play. This is a disputed play. Everybody's looking at the same replay, and half the people are saying he's out, and half the people are saying he's safe, and they're not going to change.
Although it is worth noting, Byron, I hear you in terms of the television aspect, that I understand why Democrats might think that. They might want, or they might believe that they can have like an Alexander Butterfield moment where they ask just the right question, and there's this dramatic pause. And then he tells the truth, and then that blows the whole thing open.
That is that's kind of an Aaron Sorkin thing.
Yeah.
Maybe he could do this. But the other thing about this resolution is Steve Scalise's complaints, in my view, are justified, but they're also totally expected. This is what the 2018 election was about. The Democrats control the House, and they're going to do that. On the other hand, this bill vests extraordinary power in Adam Schiff, and Adam Schiff alone. Do we want to call some hearings? Well, Adam Schiff will decide that. Do you want to have witnesses? Well, you can ask Adam Schiff. He can or cannot give them to you as he chooses. Do you want these deposition transcripts released? He can release them, but again, he doesn't have to. Extraordinary power. Nancy Pelosi is kind of like the chairman of the board here, and she has designated Adam Schiff as the CEO of this impeachment.
Swin, to that point, I wonder if this presents some kind of a risk, both in the nature of the straight party line vote and also to the Democrats, because of the unanimous vociferous opposition from the GOP, of course, but also just the nature of it. I mean, if Adam Schiff is imbued with so much of this power, it makes him a very easy whipping boy for the GOP. It makes him the person that you can put on ads that run in the 2020 election. It feels like, I don't know, the Republicans almost have individuals they can point to and say, see, that's the person who's screwing this up.
Sure, absolutely. But I mean, at this point, is there a single thing that Democrats could do, whether it's in terms of process or messaging or anything, that isn't going to be played that way by the other side? I'm just absolutely unconvinced, especially not just having lived through the past 2 or 3 years, but the past, several decades of Republican messaging going back to the Clinton era, that there was anything that they could do to not have it played up in the way you're talking about. So, I mean, fine, we can have process arguments, but I think ultimately it's sort of meaningless. And it's a little bit rich to hear some of this coming from the same congressional Republicans if you examine even an iota of the way that they acted in the first 2 years of the Trump presidency. But that's a bigger nut to crack that we can perhaps get into later. But they're going to keep hollering on about Soviet style, this and that, till the end of time, because they think it's messaging that works. And have at it. But at this point, people in the upper echelons of Trump world who I've talked to, unsurprisingly, have all determined that impeachment at the hands of the House Democrats is a foregone conclusion. The President of the United States has come around to that as well, even though at the beginning of this whole impeachment inquiry, he kind of went back and forward when he was talking to people privately about whether he thought Democrats and Nancy Pelosi were actually going to pull the trigger. Some of his legal counsel, such as Jay Sekulow, said the exact same stuff on the record weeks ago, obviously singing it different to now. So, I mean, that's baked in. I don't think that surprises anybody, especially at this point. But something that President Trump has been privately complaining about for May days, if not weeks, is that he believed that Senate Republicans, not House Republicans, but Senate Republicans had not been fighting for him hard enough, had not been messaging hardcore enough, had not been pulling out enough theatrics or dirty tactics or whatever you want to call it. But even though they're now pulling out all the stops in the West Wing to ensure that Republicans, if it gets to the Senate, clear the president's name, acquit him, they're still convinced that that's the way it's going to go. I mean, I think that's the conventional wisdom. I think it's right. Like, you are not going to see a President Pence in 2020. It's just not going
to
happen.
Well, and Anita, partly to the point that Swin was making in terms of what Republican senators might do, Ed in Illinois asked, can the Republican-led Senate subpoena texts, emails, phone records of House leaders to see if they were releasing info from closed-door hearings to the media or had already made up their minds before the process even began, as Republicans have been saying all along?
I don't think that Mitch McConnell is interested in any of that. Remember, he is the leader, the Republican leader of the Senate. He has said that he would be legally obliged to bring this up if there's sort of a trial phase here. So,
and bring it up swiftly.
Bring it up swiftly. That doesn't mean it's going to be a full trial as we might think. We don't know what that means exactly, but I don't think he's interested in getting into all of that. I think he's interested in dismissing this pretty summarily. I mean, we know as of now, right now, there's no votes in the Senate for this, for Senate Republicans. There are not enough votes to basically remove the president from office.
And Byron Drew tweeted, as an independent, I believe both parties are exhibiting bad form with zero transparency for the American public. We'll talk more about this in a minute, but, you know, independents are the plurality, if not the majority, of the electorate, and they're looking at this thinking about 2020.
Everybody's looking at it thinking about 2020. I mean, in excluding 1868, which is kind of a different thing, in the last two impeachments, Nixon and Clinton, both presidents, were impeached after they had been reelected in 1972 and 1996, respectively. We haven't had one in the modern era in which the party that is seeking to defeat the president a year from now is now impeaching him. And clearly some Democrats believe that if they do it right, this impeachment will damage the president going into the election.
We'll pick up there when we continue the roundup with Byron York of The Washington Examiner, Swin Subsang of The Daily Beast, and Politico's Anita Kumar. As we go to break, you're listening to Spanish Moon by the 70s rock band Little Feat. Its guitarist Paul Barrere died this week at the age of 71. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Google. From Connecticut to California, from Mississippi to Minnesota, millions of American businesses are using Google tools to grow online. The Grow with Google initiative supports small businesses by providing free digital skills workshops and one-on-one coaching in all 50 states, helping businesses get online, connect with new customers, and work more productively. Learn more at google.com/grow.
Think of NPR's Life Kit as that friend who always has great advice about everything from how to invest to how to get a great workout. We bring you tools to help you get it together. New episodes every Tuesday and Thursday. Listen and subscribe to Life Kit All Guides.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. New employment numbers out today show the job market has lost some momentum. The economy added 128,000 jobs in October. Job growth over the prior 3 months had averaged higher than that, at 176,000 jobs per month. Many economists expected a drop last month because of the General Motors strike, which cut 50,000 workers from the employment rolls. That strike is over, which could improve this month's report. It's the Friday News Roundup with Politico's Anita Kumar, Swin Subsang of The Daily Beast, and Byron York of The Washington Examiner. Matt tweeted, I am pro-impeachment, but I don't know how we get back to normal after this. I believe this political divide will be the new norm going forward. It seems the American experiment is irreparably damaged, and I don't see things changing in my lifetime, and I'm only 35. Swin, could you react to that? Partly because we've always had a political divide.
Right.
It's always been nasty around impeachment. Like, this is not, this may feel more acute because of, say, social media and 24-hour cable news. I mean, Matt and I are not far off in age, but this ain't new.
I didn't live through the 1960s or the early 70s, but I hear some stuff happened there.
One or two things, yeah.
Yeah, at least one or two things.
Right.
And I mean, I get what people are saying. You see what plays on TV, radio, whatever, every day. You see stuff on social media. You see the polls that have been coming out since the Obama era that do seem to indicate that, at least as far as public polling goes, that there is more of an emphatically stated and publicly known political divide than we've seen in maybe years or decades past. And I don't want to discount that or downplay that, but, and I don't mean to sound like a little bit of a nihilist about it, but I mean, just from what I've read in history textbooks, online, in nonfiction books, I have a hard time believing that the Nixon era was comfier than it is now, not just in terms of political polarization and intense divides over the Vietnam War and other issues, but even on pet issues of the national press, such as war on the press issues. Like Nixon was worse than President Trump was on that, especially messaging. There were top henchmen of Nixon who actually started planning out literal assassination of a journalist.
Well, and Spiro Agnew was very open in saying that perhaps we should look for the problem not in the halls of power in Washington, but in the,
right.
You know, the television networks of New York.
So Donald Trump adds a reality TV flair to a lot of this stuff, but it's not new. To think it's an aberration of the American political character is wrong. It is very much intrinsic to it.
Anita, I'd like you to respond to a question from Aaron, who asked on our Facebook page, can the panel please compare these rules, or maybe anyone on the panel, since Aaron is asking it to all three of you, can the panel please compare these rules on the impeachment investigation to the ones passed by the Republican House during the Clinton impeachment? How are they the same, and how do they differ?
My understanding is they're pretty similar. Maybe it's correct that the chairman of the committees have more power in this scenario, but I believe that basically the majority party had the power just like this, and the minority was allowed to do certain things. So it's generally the same.
We also, Byron, have gone from the era of like an independent counsel to a very different kind of process. So the rules may be the same, but the investigative process around the inquiry is
well,
not.
Yeah, I was about to say this. In the Watergate era, the Watergate hearings in the Senate had taken place in 1973. They were before the House got around to it. And then in the Clinton years, there was an independent counsel, Kenneth Starr, who investigated all the stuff and gave a very detailed report based on grand jury testimony to the House, which they used as their roadmap for impeachment. Even in the Mueller period, we had a special prosecutor putting together a report and then making it public, essentially giving it to Congress. What's different here is, since Democrats jumped on this Ukraine thing so fast, I mean, you remember Nancy Pelosi announced an inquiry the day before the president released the rough transcript of the telephone call. The House is functioning kind of as the investigative body, too. And that's the source of a lot of this friction with these secret depositions. I'm one of these ones who's been saying they should be made public. They don't have to be held in public. That's not necessary. But we do need to see transcripts of what was actually said in these things. So it's this investigative function that people are fighting over so much. And only then, I guess, the Intelligence Committee is kind of functioning as the independent counsel, then they'll send it over to the Judiciary Committee, and it'll be more like a traditional impeachment.
Speaking of the behind closed doors testimony, Swin, we've learned quite a bit this week from some of the folks who testified. We've heard from Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vintman, who is the National Security Council's top Ukraine expert, Tom Morrison, who is the Director of European Affairs for the NSC. Some of the committees are still trying to get John Bolton to testify. They've scheduled him for next week, at least. What are the one or two big things that we learned from this week's testimony, at least what we could glean from sources who talked about the testimony?
I mean, the biggest element of it, and it's something that whether you're talking to a Republican politician or a Democratic politician, they'll spin it in different ways. But basically, the hard facts of what these people keep corroborating is that they believe there was, in essence, a quid pro quo being executed by Trump and some of his top officials with regards to his dealings with the Ukrainian president, military aid, and trying to get multiple investigations publicly announced by the Ukrainians, including but not limited to looking into Joe and Hunter Biden. Joe Biden, obviously headed into an election year, is going to be, or likely going to be, one of Trump's top political foes on the Democratic side. So right now we're sort of haggling over the price of this, with conservatives and pro-Trump allies saying differing versions of what's the big deal. And obviously, Democratic foes of the president saying that this is Watergate 2.0, Iran-Contra 2.0, whatever you want to call it. But when it comes to President Trump himself, he will not stop saying that it was a perfect phone call and that this changes nothing. Where's the whistleblower? Even though we've had enough testimony from people on the record, well, behind closed doors, that is, that seems to be corroborating what the whistleblower is saying. So the president continues to have this fixation, as do a lot of Republicans, on this anonymous whistleblower, whereas you could argue at this point it doesn't really matter what the identity of the whistleblower is if there are all these other names, people putting their names to things that the whistleblower was alleging in the anonymous complaint.
If they're corroborating what was in the complaint. We want to move on from impeachment because, there, believe it or not, there was other news in Washington this week. But Anita, what should we expect next week?
Well, there's 8 more people scheduled to give these to talk to Congress. We don't know if all of those people will show up. That's basically the thing we wonder every day. Are these people going to cooperate or not? What I've been surprised about is how many people have cooperated, decided to come forward, sometimes with a subpoena, mostly with a subpoena. So we have these 8 more coming, and then the week after is when things will start to become public.
Before we move on, look, I know that this story is dizzying. This is like a Game of Thrones-esque storyline that just keeps changing and changing. There's a really easy reference guide online. It's npr.org/impeachment. It has all the details, the timeline of everything, who's who, all the related documents, a tracker of who supports impeachment, who doesn't support impeachment, and it'll be updated as the story continues to move. So if you ever find yourself just your eyes crossing because this is getting complicated, your best bet for one-stop summary of everything is npr.org/impeachment. Another story out of Capitol Hill this week involved California Congresswoman Katie Hill. She was a freshman Democrat who won a long-held Republican seat last year. Congresswoman Hill announced that she's resigning. Now, this happened after nude photos of her were published by some conservative websites and amid an ethics probe into whether she had inappropriate relationships with House staffers. Here is part of what she said on the House floor in discussing her resignation.
I am leaving now because of a double standard. I am leaving because I no longer want to be used as a bargaining chip. I'm leaving because I didn't want to be peddled by papers and blogs and websites used by shameless operatives for the dirtiest gutter politics that I've ever seen, and the right-wing media to drive clicks and expand their audience by distributing intimate photos of me taken without my knowledge, let alone my consent, for the sexual entertainment of millions. I'm leaving because of a misogynistic culture that gleefully consumed my naked pictures, capitalized on my sexuality, and enabled my abusive ex to continue that abuse, this time with the entire country watching. I am leaving because of the thousands of vile, threatening emails, calls, and texts that made me fear for my life and the lives of the people that I care about.
That was California Democratic Congresswoman Katie Hill speaking on the House floor. Anita, I'm wondering what your sense is of what the story is here. There's the ethics piece of this, and then there's just the revenge porn piece of this. Congresswoman Hill maintains that she is the victim of an abusive ex who is trying to get back at her and that her devices were hacked to release pictures that were on them. What's the real story here as you see it?
Well, I think there's a couple things. She has said that she's going to leave office and continue to sort of be an advocate and talk about these things, the revenge porn. I really think the thing is what she was talking about, that this is the thing that's going to get a lot of attention going forward is, are men and women treated differently? You know, these rules that she is accused of violating, having a relationship with one of her staffers, which she denies, is a new rule that came up after the Me Too movement. And it's sort of ironic that the first person that sort of caught up in this is a woman and not a man, because the allegation is that there have been men that have violated, that have had relationships with staffers, even when, you know, they might have been unethical, but it wasn't on the books as something that was, you know, inappropriate by House rules. So here we are a year later, and it's a woman that has been caught up in this. Now, she's denying this. There are allegations that she did do something wrong, and we don't know that. But I do think there's a lot of attention paid by a lot of women that men and women are treated differently.
Byron, I wonder what your sense is of how Congress has responded. I mean, Florida Republican Matt Gaetz told Fox News last night there's a generational divide on Hill's resignation and that many millennials can identify with what Hill is experiencing. I haven't heard much. Granted, the whole impeachment inquiry thing has drowned out everything. But I haven't heard a whole lot about this, including the fact that one of the people who has announced that he wants to run for her seat is George Papadopoulos, who is the man who literally touched off the Mueller probe.
Well, I mean, there have been reports that Nancy Pelosi said privately of course, Nancy Pelosi is nearly 80 years old and grew up in a time when not everyone had a cell phone camera in their pocket, said you got to be really careful about the pictures that are taken of you and what are done. There's a battle going on about what this the Katie Hill case means. Is it a feminist issue or is it an issue of being improperly involved with staff? And I believe one of the nude pictures, correct me if I'm wrong, was of her naked with a campaign staffer. Not one of her Hill staffers, but a campaign staffer. And there was this allegation that she also had an improper relationship with a Hill staffer as well. And that's a fair amount of stuff, regardless of the party, the naked bong party pictures.
This is a pure ethics matter.
Which were in, well, absolutely.
Just pointing out, she did admit that she had the relationship with the campaign staffer.
Yeah. Right.
Right. The open question, which may or may not get resolved at this point, is, as the people here pointed out, is the allegation, which she still emphatically denies, even though she's copped to the other one, as Anita just pointed out, did she have an inappropriate relationship with a congressional staffer? Which, of course, if that did violate ethics rules, she should be held accountable to that, as would a male in her position. So there's nothing misogynistic or sexist about that. In fact, that would be the exact opposite. But thing is, now that she's resigning, we're not going to get to that point, and this allegation may just stand unanswered for God knows how long. And it's so two things can be true at once. If she did do that, which again she emphatically denies, I don't think anybody here knows if she did or didn't, then that would be wrong via House rules. And also you can highlight the abhorrent nature of the revenge porn aspect of the story. Two things can be true at once. There doesn't need to be a perfect hero here on either side. And the some of the coverage of it, including like the naked bong photo, like at the end of the day, I mean, who cares? Who's being hurt there? What rule is being violated? What's the impropriety? What is the point of airing someone's dirty laundry like that in the national press except to humiliate and degrade? There's no ethical question to that on the side of holding Katie Hill accountable.
So this is one ethical gray area that the political sphere is dealing with. Another story dealing with another ethical gray area had to do with the nature of social media and the upcoming election. Facebook's gotten a lot of flack, obviously, for the impact of Russian interference in 2016. This week, the CEO of Twitter, Jack Dorsey, announced his decision to stop all political advertising on Twitter around the world. He sent out a tweet thread explaining the decision. Of course he did. He's the CEO of Twitter. And it reads in part, quote, "This isn't about free expression. This is about paying for reach. And paying to increase the reach of political speech has significant ramifications that today's democratic infrastructure may not be prepared to handle. It's worth stepping back in order to address," unquote. Anita, many people who have applauded this decision are now looking at Facebook and saying, okay, your turn. I think that if Jack Dorsey had been the owner of the Washington Post instead of Twitter, he could have been taken to the Supreme Court and lost because paid political speech is free speech. But he's right. This is one of those gray areas where we really don't have a good answer.
We don't. But he didn't mention Facebook, but that's sort of the subtext here,
yeah.
Which is, okay, we've done our part. What about you, Facebook? And you saw Hillary Clinton and you saw other people now saying, hey, they acted. Where's Facebook on this? And we know where they are. They have said that that they do not plan to ban this, that they can't determine whether political ads are correct or not, and it shouldn't matter. That's people should be able to take out ads. Important to note that this is each year that comes by, this becomes a bigger deal, right? Social media is taking on a bigger life every day. It's a $6 billion industry in terms of these political ads. So it is significant, perhaps more significant on the money part to Facebook than Twitter, but it's a step that a lot of Democrats want to see happen.
We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make safer journeys for everyone. For starters, all drivers are background checked before their first ride and screened on an ongoing basis. And now Uber has introduced a brand new safety feature called Ride Check, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please do take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating so that other people can find the show too. Thanks.
The past decade saw a lot of changes in the way music is made, shared, and experienced. Social media blew up, genres blurred together, and Beyoncé dominated nearly everything. I'm Robin Hilton. Join NPR Music as we look back at the 2010s, its defining trends and moments. Listen to new episodes twice a week on All Songs Considered from NPR.
Back now to the roundup with Anita Kumar, Swin Subsang, and Byron York. Jay wrote on our Facebook page, regarding Twitter and political advertising, the political problem on social media, especially Twitter, isn't political advertising. The problem is incendiary political speech, libel, lies, and blatant misrepresentation. Donald Trump has arguably amassed much of his social capital by consistently violating the terms of service at Twitter and circulating the most vile and untruthful content of any public figure. He has broken the terms of service quite a bit, including, I think, with that video where he took footage from the movie Kingsman: The Secret Service and superimposed the logos of news organizations over the heads of people who the main character massacres in a church.
Trump like, didn't he, tweet that, though.
But I don't he retweeted, think he tweeted it.
He did.
Retweeted it.
Really?
He did. Yes. I mean, he spread that tweet around. So, but even beyond that, if I had tweeted some of the things the president had, I would be banned for life.
Well, I think that Twitter almost has a presidential exception for this, that when Trump does something, it's by definition news, and they allow it to appear.
I thought you were going to quote Richard Nixon from the Frost interview when the president tweets that it's not illegal. I'm sorry. I thought that was where you were going.
On this ad thing, I have to say my opinion, I'm on Facebook's side on this. Their position is basically that political speech is not only some of the most important speech in our national conversation, it's some of the most scrutinized speech in our national conversation, and that scrutiny should be done by journalists and political opponents and not a group of techies. At Facebook, I should say here, because I have to, that I was one of the small number of conservative journalists who went out to Palo Alto and had dinner at Zuckerberg's house and off-the-record dinner. Another point that he makes, and it made in his speech at Georgetown, is that it's hard to figure out what is a political ad. We have ads that are done by the Trump campaign or the Warren campaign, but there are tons of advocacy groups that post ads related to an election. It's a very, very large subject and with lines that are very difficult to draw once you start drawing them.
And Swin, I think Facebook's leadership in particular has been much more, at least visibly, engaged with Capitol Hill in terms of saying, we agree that we need to have a conversation. We agree there need to be regulations. We want to be part of the discussion so that something is not imposed on them that they dislike. Jack Dorsey has been a little bit more reticent, but I don't know that Mark Zuckerberg's openness has gained him fans on Capitol Hill.
No, I don't think so. And actually, a little interesting subplot of this whole Zuckerberg-related saga is if you look at what his image was in the mid-Obama era and the perception among a lot of establishment Democrats of him, it was resoundingly more positive. They saw him as a tech giant ally. The group he helped started, it was heralded as something that would help push through immigration reform finally in the Obama era. Obviously, that did not happen. And a lot of this is because of hurt feelings over the 2016 election. I'm sorry to say, not all of it, but some of it is because a lot of Democrats, activists, some politicians, what have you, do think that Facebook helped elect Donald Trump with the misinformation that was spread on it. And it has contributed somewhat, not entirely, but somewhat to Zuckerberg's image or perception as a villain among a good chunk of the progressive base, which is 100% contra to how he was perceived in the mid-Obama era. Now, they don't think he's a closet conservative. They don't think he's running around wearing the MAGA hat. But a lot of progressives who have already started to see big tech as a monopoly and a deleterious force that does need more regulation or oversight, has started to point to Zuckerberg more and more and more. And that trend will continue. And none of that is gaining Zuckerberg any new friends on the right. But that's a whole different question.
Kay in Silver Spring, Maryland emailed, why is the CEO of Boeing not being considered as a criminal rather than just being asked to step down? Interesting question, Kay, but Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg was on Capitol Hill this week. He apologized Tuesday to the families of those who died in two 737 MAX jet crashes within the last year. He made the apology 1 year after the first crash, a Lion Air jetliner, as he testified in front of a Senate committee.
On behalf of myself and the Boeing company, we are sorry, deeply and truly sorry. As a husband and father myself, I'm heartbroken by your losses.
Muilenburg also appeared before a House committee on Wednesday, and he said in part, quote, regulators around the world should approve the return of the MAX to the skies only after they have applied the most rigorous scrutiny and are completely satisfied as to the plane's safety, unquote. This is the first time that Boeing executives have testified since the Lion Air and Ethiopian Airlines jetliners crashed. 20 people who lost loved ones in the Ethiopian Airlines crash were at the Tuesday hearing. Let's back up to some of the politics surrounding the president, Anita, with one comment from John that I'd like to get your reaction to. John wrote on our Facebook page, it's becoming rather clear that the Republicans are afraid of their own base and will happily throw themselves on a live grenade to protect this president. In the end, does it matter? The actual precedent that buries Trump is state tax fraud crimes in New York.
Well, I mean, it's true about the Republicans here. I mean, no matter what you say, no matter what has happened, what controversy over the last 2.5 years, the president seems to remain popular with a certain segment of society. His supporters are sticking with him. And so you see Republicans on Capitol Hill that feel that they need to stick with the president. Those that haven't stuck with him are retiring, or they are going to be primaried, and they sort of know that political future. So people have stuck with him. What the person is referring to on the tax fraud, you know, I think there's a lot of investigations that the president is going through. I mean, we're so caught up in Washington with the impeachment and the Ukraine call, we forget. You know, I did a story that there were 15 outside investigations into Donald Trump all over the country on taxes, on his business, on so many other things. And some of those are criminal investigations. All of those are criminal investigations. He has lawsuits. So there's a lot more that could come out that we might see in the next year that is outside of Washington. And the caller is correct, or the person that's writing it is correct, that any of those things can come true. And I don't know that we have all that information yet.
Well, but briefly, Byron, even if those did, you know, come to light, there's still the question as to whether or not you can even charge a sitting president. So even then, it would have to wait until after he's out of office.
I do think through all the investigations of the past 3 years, among some Democrats, there's been this belief that there's always something big just around the corner. I mean, this collusion is really huge. And then when it's not turning out to be quite as huge, you know, this New York stuff, it's really big. SDNY is really going to get him. How about emoluments? How about his other business deals? How about Ukraine? Now Ukraine is the really big thing. I think that there's almost a Roadrunner Wile E. Coyote characteristic to this. And so far, nothing has turned out to be exactly what they hoped. Now we're in the middle of perhaps the biggest project yet, with the House actually impeaching him. But so far, it hasn't really worked the way they hoped.
We should note on the West Coast that the National Weather Service has issued its first ever extreme red flag warning this week as parts of California continue to burn. Fires are burning up and down the state, fueled by rushing winds. They came within a few feet of the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley. That fire is still burning, but the library plans to be open today. Reports suggest that firefighters are starting to get a handle on the Kincaid Fire, which is north of San Francisco. Yesterday, a new fire broke out northwest of Los Angeles in Ventura County. Forecasters expect strong winds and low humidity in Southern California. Parts of Northern California woke up to a freeze warning, but temperatures should still rise above normal this weekend. We should also talk about Abubakar al-Baghdadi before we go. On Sunday, the president shared new details of the raid that killed the ISIS leader. Here's part of what he said in a televised address from the White House.
The U.S. personnel were incredible. I got to watch much of it. No personnel were lost in the operation. while a large number of Baghdadi's fighters and companions were killed with him. He died after running into a dead-end tunnel, whimpering and crying and screaming all the way.
Now, Anita, some of the national security officials, including the defense secretary, Mark Esper, have called some of the details of that into question. What do we actually know about what happened?
Well, you're exactly right. There are U.S. officials who are saying they don't know those specific details that the president was talking about, that how he acted like a coward at the end, and he whimpered like a dog, I think he said. So those details aren't known. What we do know is he was killed. We do know some of those details that the president said are exactly true. But this is a president we've seen over and over who likes to have things as a sort of theatrical. He likes to embellish. He likes to tell a good story. He likes to be on TV telling that. And so although it has made some of his officials uncomfortable, some of the details that he's revealed and the way he reveals it, that is the way he continues to do it.
And Swin, one of the other aspects of this in announcing al-Baghdadi's death is that the president kind of departed from his standard criticism of the intelligence community. He praised their work, but he also said he's dealing with, in his words, people who aren't very intelligent having to do with intel. So a little bit of a pullback, but still not completely.
Other Trumpian flourishes that he couldn't help but not divert from when he was giving this pretty important national address wasn't just what you just talked about, but he also took time to say that ISIS is pretty good at social media, but not as great as Donald Trump is. And he also referenced multiple times, not just one, but multiple best-selling books of his. And how right he was in one of them, allegedly, about Osama bin Laden before the 9/11 attacks happened. So during the course of this, we have multiple senior administration officials, both on the record and otherwise, saying that they have no idea where the president got the crying and whimpering details, alleged details of Baghdadi's violent passing. And we have him pimping both his best-selling books from years and decades past, and how great he is at Twitter.com. I can't think of any other way this particular president would have announced the death of the ISIS leader.
Byron, one more thing we should note, that on Wednesday, Senate Finance Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley of Iowa and Homeland Security Committee Chairman Ron Johnson of Wisconsin asked the Attorney General to make the DOJ's Russia investigation findings public. Why did they ask for that briefly?
Well, this came after news that it had, this is the John Durham investigation, it turned into a criminal investigation, that Durham was using a grand jury to get evidence. And I think there's a fear. There's a balance between a criminal procedure and public disclosure. And most Republicans on the Hill want public disclosure. And when something becomes a criminal case, people lawyer up. There's a grand jury involved. There's secrecy involved. And that's exactly the opposite of what a number of Republicans want. I think they don't want to hang anybody. They want the public to know what happened.
Before we go, the impeachment process that we've been talking about today is rightly being called historic. But the Washington Nationals rewrote some of the history books on Wednesday night. An estimated 27 million people watched them beat the Houston Astros in Game 7 to win the World Series. DC has not won in 95 years, back when a team called the Senators took the title. This year's championship broke a lot of records. The Nationals had the worst start ever for a championship team. They'd lost 31 of their first 50 games. This was the first World Series where the visiting team won every game. The Nats also had the league's oldest roster, with an average age of about 31. Washington's Fernando Rodney is the oldest active player in the majors. He's 42. Some of the Nats call themselves Los Viejos, which is Spanish for the old guys. And the Nats have a strong Latino presence. Their victory song is Calma, a reggaeton hit celebrating the beauty of Puerto Rico. The team's other anthem is the walk-on music for Gerardo Parra, Baby Shark. You can expect to hear that at tomorrow's parade, like it or not. The celebration will run along the National Mall from the Washington Monument east to the Capitol. Baseball has a way of sparing us from the crises of the day. Back in 1998, I remember the home run race between Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa giving me a break from President Clinton's scandal over Monica Lewinsky. Many New Yorkers took pride in the first game after 9/11. The Mets beat the Braves 3-2. The Yankees made it to that World Series, where a tattered flag from Ground Zero waved over the crowd in Game 3. This impeachment is historic, but history's made all the time, and not always through tragedy. Well, Astros fans might consider this a tragedy, but you know what I mean. The point is, look, whatever may happen with Congress and President Trump, we'll bring you the latest. But there's always more to life than politics. And as vital as it is for us to keep a close eye on Washington, sometimes it really is okay to look away. Anita Kumar is Politico's White House correspondent. Anita, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thanks.
Aswin Subsang, White House reporter for The Daily Beast. Thank you, Swin.
Anytime.
And Byron York, chief political correspondent for The Washington Examiner. Thanks, Byron.
Thanks for having me.
Our lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Neonai. Our digital producers are Gabrielle Healy and Christopher Castano. We will dive into the international section of the roundup in just a moment. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. ISIS's Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi sought the annihilation of those that he and his movement deemed impure. Now he and his heir apparent are dead, killed in back-to-back attacks by U.S. forces this week. Here is how President Trump described Baghdadi's final moments.
He was screaming, crying, and whimpering. And he was scared out of his mind.
Those details have been called into question, but ISIS has confirmed their deaths, warning America, quote, "Do not be happy," unquote. Meanwhile, political turmoil has rocked South America, and widespread protests in the Middle East has led to some talk of an Arab fall. Lots to get to today on the Friday News Roundup, and joining us around the table are Jennifer Williams, the foreign editor of Vox and co-host of the podcast Worldly. Jennifer, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thanks for having me.
Fernando Pizarro, the Washington correspondent for Univision. Fernando, welcome back.
Happy to be back.
And Abdurahim Fukara, the Washington bureau chief for Al Jazeera. Abdurahim, good to have you with us.
Delighted to be here.
Last night, the United States brought the world's number one terrorist leader to justice. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is dead.
It's been less than a week since the president made that announcement, but we've learned a lot more about the terrorist leader's death and its implications for the region. Jennifer Williams, let me start with you. Just give us the basic bio on who Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was and why his death matters.
Sure. So he was the caliph of the ISIS caliphate. They declared this caliphate, and it was he who did that, standing in a mosque in Mosul, Iraq. He basically declared that, you know, ISIS was back on the scene. His background, he has a master's degree in Quranic studies. He did his master's thesis on really obscure Quranic interpretation. He was a soccer player. He, you know, was very religious as a young man. Then the Iraq War happens, the U.S. invasion of Iraq. He gets caught up in that. He ends up being arrested and imprisoned in Camp Buka, which was a U.S.-run Iraqi prison. Kind of became a jihadist training ground with a lot of people, you know, connected up and made connections. And when he got out, he basically took over a fledgling organization that was still kind of the remnants of a previous al-Qaeda organization in Iraq. Ends up basically reconstituting this organization. You have Syria's kind of civil war starts. He's able to basically capitalize on the chaos there, ends up exploding back onto the scene, taking over entire swaths of Iraq, parts of Syria, and launching this global caliphate that he described. He was the figurehead. He was the commander. He was a very important figure. And his death, at least very much from a symbolic perspective, is a huge blow to ISIS.
Now, President Trump said that in Baghdadi's final moments, he was whimpering and crying. But a top U.S. military commander, General Frank McKenzie, has tried to kind kind of slow down or temper that version of events. Here's part of what General McKenzie said.
I can tell you this. He crawled into a hole with two small children and blew himself up while his people stayed on the ground. You can deduce what kind of person it is based on that activity. So that would be just my empirical observation of what he did. I'm not able to confirm anything else about his last seconds. I just can't confirm that one way or another.
General Frank McKenzie also shared video of that raid. Abdur-Rahim, what do we know for sure about how the operation to get al-Baghdadi was carried out?
Well, we know that he detonated himself at the end of the process. President Donald Trump mentioned him being captured, and then he blew himself up, which doesn't seem to add up. But at the end of the day, whether what we heard from President Trump or what we heard from others, such as McKenzie and the Defense Secretary Esper, it all goes towards saying that, you know, it was a highly complex operation, and it was highly coordinated. It was a little interesting and puzzling that President Donald Trump thanked various other players who had something to do with this. He mentioned Russia, he mentioned Turkey, he mentioned the Kurds, but he also mentioned Syria. And it's very hard to know what exactly he meant by Syria. Did he mean the president of Bashar al-Assad? What we're hearing from the State Department is that the situation in terms of relations between the Trump administration and the regime of Bashar al-Assad, if that was what the president meant, remained the same. There are no direct contacts with the regime of Bashar al-Assad. Did he mean some sort of faction of Syrian fighters pro-US? It's very unclear. But one thing is clear is that Baghdadi is gone, and that it has played out in so many different ways, both inside the United States and outside the United States. The event came smack in the middle of huge protests in various parts of the Middle East. It didn't knock news of those protests off the radar in the Middle East. It managed to knock off the radar stuff that was happening here in the United States, in the United States Congress, with regard to the Ukraine situation. But we know Baghdadi is gone, and as Jennifer said, on a symbolic level, it's huge. But in terms of what will the actual impact of it be on history and politics in the Middle East, it remains to be unseen.
Worth noting that the operation to take Baghdadi took place in kind of the northwest corner of Syria, in sort of the Aleppo area, right near the Syria-Turkey border. But again, it's not entirely clear what role Syria and Turkey played, whether they just allowed U.S. troops to move in or how that worked. Ferdinando?
On the whimpering and crying issue that the president insisted so much upon when he made the announcement, we were just talking about this a little bit before the show. And the question is whether it is theatrical or not. Did he exaggerate or not? That it's still, you know, up for question. But he had one message as part of his speech in which he said, I want people to know this because I want any followers in Western countries or in the United States, disaffected youth that may want to be followers of the Islamic State, to know how he died. So whether he had a point in this exaggeration or not, he may have with this message. If not, it was just typical Trump.
Jennifer?
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to say, you know, we tend to rarely give Trump credit for much because he doesn't necessarily deserve much credit for a lot of things. But I will say, in this respect, this was a very successful counterterrorism raid. Right. I mean, he didn't operate and orchestrate it himself, but he is the commander in chief and he did give the final, you know, sign off for this raid. It was incredibly complex, like Abdur-Rahim said. You know, it involved fewer than, I think, 100 U.S. forces. You know, 8 helicopters took off from, you know, a base near Erbil, Iraq, and flew in. They had to coordinate coordinate with Russian and Turkish airspace, which is, you know, one of the reasons why they thanked, you know, Russia and why Trump thanked Russia and Turkey.
Basically flying across the northern edge of Syria from Iraq into Syria.
Right. And then, you know, they land in the dead of night, which, you know, most raids like this do happen at night because it's harder to see, I think people know. But, you know, it was this really kind of, you know, the timing was perfect. They knew he was there with this, you know, percentage of certainty, but you never know for sure, right? Things can go very wrong. There were no U.S. Fatalities. They were able to evacuate some of the children besides the two that Baghdadi chose to kill, you know, and they ended up, you know, demolishing the site. They got a lot of hopefully useful documentation and, you know, sources and resources out of the compound they were able to exploit. They stayed in about 2 hours before they blew up the entire compound. So in terms of, you know, a big counterterrorism raid, you know, if we give President Obama credit for the Osama bin Laden raid, which I think people do, and rightfully so, then I think it's equally fair to give President Trump some credit for the Baghdadi raid, because it was very successful and very, you know, important.
Let's get to some of your questions. Peter emailed, is it not emblematic of a worrisome lack of intelligence that the West seems to know virtually nothing about Baghdadi's successor? Abdurrahim, the president, it's worth noting, tweeted this morning around 9:40, ISIS has a new leader. We know exactly who he is. And ISIS announced that they had a new leader. We know his name. We know that he exists. But what more do we know about him?
Well, we know very little, except that we know something very important, at least one thing very important about him. We know one thing very important that confirms something that we have always known about ISIS. So the leader, the caliph, as Jennifer said in her opening remarks, you know, in early Islamic jurisprudence, the leader of the emir, the leader of the faithful, has to have certain qualities. One of those qualities, one of those conditions that he has to fulfill, is that he has to be from the tribe of the Prophet Muhammad, the tribe of the Prophet Muhammad, Quraysh. So this guy is now. His name is Qureshi. So we have that established. And that has, from the perspective of ISIS and the supporters of ISIS, that has huge significance in terms of the legitimacy that he brings to the job of leading ISIS, particularly that he's come to replace not just anyone, he's come to replace al-Baghdadi, who did announce the rise of the caliphate when he did in Mosul.
Jennifer, I wonder if you could answer Jacob's question. Jacob asked, what capabilities does ISIS have? Are they still active?
Sure. They are still active, but not in the way that they were previously or at their peak. So there are still, the estimates vary, but, you know, a few thousand to as many as, you know, maybe 10, 15,000. But I think those estimates are perhaps a bit high, but there are at least several thousand active ISIS fighters. But what ISIS looks like now is very different. It's much more of a kind of insurgency in terms of, you know, blending in with the population rather than holding territory, right? They don't have access to the same resources. Those oil fields that President Trump has talked about in Syria that the U.S. is now going to defend, those were previously in the, you know, around 2011, were held by ISIS. They used that to smuggle oil to sell to everyone from the Assad regime and beyond, which gave them a lot of resources. They obviously controlled huge swaths of Iraq, which also gave them a lot of resources. So, you know, they used to be this big, powerful kind of terrorist juggernaut, but that was never really sustainable. You know, they didn't have any allies. They don't have any natural allies. They don't have, you know, any big international backers. So it was only a matter of time that the caliphate, as they described it, was going to fail. So now we're in that kind of later phase. They do still have capabilities of carrying out terrorist attacks that are, you know, fairly devastating, mostly in the region. They're less, it seems, able to inspire the kind of broader international terror attacks, in part because, you know, a lot of their attraction in, you know, the early days was that they were this big, powerful kind of movement, that, you know, they were on the rise. And now they just look kind of like a bunch of losers. They literally lost their caliphate. I'm okay with calling them losers. I don't know if that's just me. But, you know, they just lost their leader. That's a huge blow. You know, whether or not he was involved in the day-to-day command is a different question. But, you know, this new leader that we're talking about, Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qureshi, you know, he is mostly an unknown, not just, you know, that earlier question about, is it, you know, a commentary on the West that we don't know who he is? Most people in ISIS probably don't know who he is, according to most analysts I've spoken to. And, you know, that's going to be potentially a problem for ISIS, because they're going to have to build up authority for this person. You know, why should I follow this random guy I've never heard of?
Alice tweeted, listening to Trump describe Baghdadi's death is disgusting. Our commander-in-chief denigrating the death of an enemy, no matter how evil he may be, dishonors the office and our nation. And Donald asked a question, Abdurrahim, that I've heard come up quite a bit, and I'd like you to answer this one quickly, and then we'll keep going. Donald tweeted, is there any truth to reports that Trump was actually playing golf when the ISIS leader was killed and the photo of him and the generals was staged after the fact?
I mean, there was obviously some back and forth about this. The operation happened about 3:30 in the afternoon. He was reported to have left the golf course at 3:30 in the afternoon that day. But we have seen the picture. I've seen people saying that it's been doctored. Very few people have said that. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think his most important message, which is about his legacy, that on his watch, al-Baghdadi was killed, and nobody can dispute that.
Let's turn now to Latin America, starting with the ongoing protests in Chile. They forced the government to pull out of hosting two major international gatherings. One was a big trade summit. The other was a climate conference. Ferdinando, you are Chilean. Could you give us your perspective on the latest on the protests? I don't think that Chile has had this kind of unrest in a very long time.
No, not in a very long time. Well, Sebastián Piñera this week, the president had to suspend APEC, which is the Asia-Pacific Economic Summit, which, as you said, important trade meeting. President Trump had said repeatedly that he would attend. We will get into that later. There's also canceled the UN-backed climate summit. It was to take place in December. Now Spain apparently has agreed or offered to host it. It's a big hit for the image of the country, for the diplomatic image, for the public image of a country that until very recently was considered a model, considered a almost developed country, part of the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. A lot of countries always listing Chile as a model, but there are some serious cracks in this model. And basically, these protests that have been going on now for exactly 2 weeks. They started the Thursday before, but they really got bad 2 weeks ago. And it's basically a general discontent over a lot of things. It started over a minor, we could say, 4 cents of a dollar hike in the metro fares. But then they went on to burn or destroy or severely damage 70 of 153 metro stations in Latin America's largest and most modern metro system. But there's a lot of discontent over things that have been happening over a lot of years. It's the gross inequality in Chile. About 1% of the population has 25% of the wealth. Poverty, has gone down to 7%, but from 30% 30 years ago. Yeah. But there are low pensions. Some salaries are not enough. A fully privatized pension system that has left a lot of people with very, very low pensions, low salaries, privatized health, privatized water supply. There's been hikes in electricity, then collusion by huge conglomerates in the prices of toilet paper, chicken, medications, and those crimes, financial crimes, have gone unpunished. There's been corruption, misappropriation of funds at the highest levels of the army, of the cops. There's been extremely high salaries for the members of Congress. So there's, in general, a lot of discontent, and it has accumulated.
So of the list of demands that the protesters have, what's at the top of the list? I mean, do they want new leadership at the top? Do they want laws changed?
There is a demand for Piñera to resign. He'd had a major shakeup in his cabinet, but it's mostly still a center-right cabinet. So I don't think there's a chance right now for him to resign or political instability to get as far as a change of government. It could happen. They're calling for a constitutional assembly as well. Now, I have to say that in Santiago particularly, there's always protests about something. There's always some march, and they tend to get a little bit out of hand. There's always the violent element that destroys bus stops. But this has been widespread. This has been nationwide, and they've been targeting supermarkets. They've been targeting pharmacies. They've been targeting hardware stores that are all parts of these big, enormous chains that represent this wealth. And basically that it's not spreading to the rest of the country.
So there's this trade conference that was canceled in Santiago. China's president Xi was supposed to meet with Chile's president on trade. So it's kind of there's economic movers on both ends. It seems like it's you have these big movers at the top and then people saying we're too low down from the bottom. You need to be more
absolutely
accountable.
Yeah, sensation, feeling from a lot of Chileans that things are not trickling down. Trickle-down economics, that sounds familiar, right?
Abdurrahim?
I mean, I find it extraordinary that in a country such as Chile, where military rule ended some 20 years ago.
30.
23 years ago. And that memory, at least in the minds of young Chileans, was not as present as it is in the memory of their parents, for example. I find it extraordinary that 23 years later, the president of Chile, actually, he declared a state of emergency.
He did, yeah.
And I know that we're going to talk about the Middle East later on, so just want to take an opportunity for a minute to say this. You know, in the Middle East, there's always been this conversation about Arab unity. What happens in one Arab country ends up happening in another country, good, bad, or ugly. It seems to me that it's the same conversation that's been going on in Latin America. To what extent Latin American countries are similar, to what extent they have the same destiny, to what extent there is a prospect for Latin American unity. But at the end of the day, when one Latin American country, especially when it's a major Latin American country, is sick, There's a historical pattern to this. You can almost be sure that other Latin American countries are also experiencing, if not the same sickness, something similar to it. We're seeing Argentina, we're seeing Brazil, we're seeing Bolivia. There's a whole wave basically sweeping through the region now at a time when there's increasing skepticism about the future of democracy, not just in Latin America, but serious questions being raised here in the United States, and that's very important to Latin Americans.
We actually got a comment about Bolivia. Tom tweeted, "Don't forget the oft-overlooked Bolivia and the chaos over Evo's attempts to fight democracy." So there have been violent clashes in Bolivia as well between supporters and opponents of the incumbent president Evo Morales. The election results are disputed. He says he won the vote on October 20th. There have been questions about voting irregularities. The Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has urged Bolivian authorities to hold a second round of voting. I'm not sure, Fernando, how that stalemate is going to break.
The United States, Colombia, Argentina, Brazil have asked for a runoff. The OAS, the Organization of American States, is sending 30 experts. They're going to audit the election over the next 12 days. As you said, on October 20th, Evo Morales, who has been in office since 2006, and it's very important to note this, he is the first indigenous president in a country that has an overwhelming indigenous population that always felt underrepresented. But he is asking for a fourth term, which is already in itself a controversy. So he needed, or the winner of this election needed 10 percentage points difference to avoid a runoff. So initially, when the exit polls came out, he didn't have a 10% over Carlos Mesa, his more centrist rival, who's also a former president. But now the results are 47.07 for Evo Morales and a 36.5 for Mesa. So then he would avoid the runoff. But these results are being contested. So this is the issue right now. And there have been some deaths in Bolivia as well over these protests. And this is going to go on for a while until anybody is willing to accept the results.
Let's go a little closer to home and update the crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. U.S. immigration authorities detained a record number of families, according to new government data, families and unaccompanied children who were trying to cross the border last year. Mexico is also having a surge in families crossing the border fleeing north from Central America. Tell us more about what's going on there and what's being done about it.
Well, Customs and Border Protection, CBP, the acting commissioner, Mark Morgan, this week released a lot of numbers. 2 weeks ago, they released the fact that almost a million migrants, 970,000, had been detained and were considered inadmissible at the border. Now, the numbers about families is in the last fiscal year, there were 473,000 family units, and about of those, 76,000 kids were unaccompanied minors that came on their own to the border. These are record numbers.
76,000 children came to the border by themselves.
Yeah, on what is considered an unaccompanied minor, that they are coming with no adult supervision, that are, it's no adult relative, yes. And this is a record-breaking figure. And you know, no matter what we say about what the policy may be, these are record-breaking numbers that the United States is trying to curtail through these third country agreements that has been trying to sign and being successful, at least with El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, not so with Mexico.
Yeah, Jennifer, do we have a sense of how well that's going in terms of curbing immigration? I mean, obviously, the administration's tried to curb immigration at our border through a number of measures, trying to restrict the routes that migrants and asylum seekers can take to remain in the U.S. Do we have a sense of how that's working so far?
Well, if the numbers are anything, it's not, right? I think part of the problem is that, you know, the way that the administration has gone about doing this and trying to get Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, and Mexico, but particularly in the Golden Triangle, those three countries, to agree to these third country agreements is by basically economic and aid coercion, by threatening to cut off U.S. aid or by actually cutting off U.S. aid. And U.S. aid isn't just this blanket aid in these countries, right? The aid programs that are involved are meant very closely tied to the immigration problem. They are meant to help do things like, you know, stamp out corruption, to build infrastructure, to build good governance. You know, they're not perfect programs, obviously, but the money isn't just blanket money. It is meant to actually solve some of the deeper underlying problems that are driving these push factors we talk about in immigration, that are pushing people to come. And by cutting those programs off and by dramatically reducing aid just in general, that is, you know, thereby actually further propelling these kind of conditions that are causing this. So, you know, on the one hand, you have them, you know, trying to push to make these countries, you know, crack down harder or, you know, control migrants. But if they could have done that, if they wanted, you know, if they were able to get people to want to stay in those countries, they would have already done so. And that's the problem here. And I think, you know, you also see that, you know, on the U.S. kind of homeland side, you know, the whole fight of the border wall is kind of this weird sideshow where, you know, if that much attention, that all the attention that's being paid to that wall were actually paid to, you know, hiring more lawyers, hiring more, you know, staffers at the border who can actually process. That's a lot of what this is, this backup is.
The immigration infrastructure.
Exactly. Is that, you know, these numbers are huge and we don't have the infrastructure to actually process people, which is why you see these, you know, babies in cages, which is why you see these, you know, facilities that CBP and ICE are controlling, because, you know, we have to process these people, but they end up in this long backlog where they're, you know, it could be 2 years before they're going to get to, you know, go in front of a judge to see if their asylum claims are valid or, you know, will be granted. And so you end up having to put them somewhere. And so that's kind of just perpetuates this nightmare at the border.
Fernando, one more Latin America story before we move on. The Trump administration announced this week that it's extending temporary protected status, which is protection from deportation, to more than 200,000 Salvadorans who are living and working in the U.S. It's part of this larger cooperation deal between the U.S. and El Salvador over border security and information sharing. And it reverses a decision from last year to end TPS for Salvadorans. Is this a bargaining chip in those negotiations? What is this?
If I have time to explain, it's sort of. It's a technical extension, but not a political extension of TPS, and I'll explain. So this week, the El Salvador president, Nayib Bukele, went on Twitter, on video, standing next to the U.S. ambassador, explaining that they had extended TPS. However, what ended up happening is DHS and El Salvador signed security and cooperation agreement on the border and aviation security. And what they have actually technically done is extend the work permits of TPS beneficiaries for El Salvador till January 4th, 2021, and then 365 days after the end of the lawsuits against the administration for ending these programs. So technically, they are extending the program because they extended the work permit. But politically, the U.S. government has not extended TPS.
Let's head now to Iraq, where the protests have intensified. At least 250 protesters have been killed in clashes with security forces since the demonstrations began early last month. Tens of thousands of people have joined the demonstrations to express their grievances against the government. Iraq's president, Barim Saleh, has now called for a new election law. He's promised Iraqis that he will approve early elections if it passes. He also says Iraq's prime minister, Adel Abdul-Mahdi, will resign once a replacement is found. Abdurrahim, what's behind these protests? What do the protesters want?
Well, the economic situation is the engine behind many of the protests going on that have been going on in the Middle East over the last 10, 12 years. And Iraq is obviously no exception, except that Iraq has its own idiosyncrasies as a political system, as a society. Iraq, a long time ago, used to be a success story in the Middle East. The economy was doing well. Iraqis generally felt very good about themselves and about where the country was going under Saddam, until he decided to go to war against Iran, and then he invaded Kuwait. His country came under sanctions, and then the invasion of 2003. Now, many of the things that are going on now in Iraq basically hark back to what happened in 2003. Before 2003, for a long time, they had always been tensions between the Shia and the Sunnis. In 2003, and there is fierce debate among Iraqis, which is the minority, which is the majority. But the Bush administration in 2003, when it carried out the invasion of Iraq, determined that the Shia were the majority. So it flipped, obviously, the power structure, and all of a sudden the Shia were in power in Iraq, ruling over the Sunnis.
So is the demand from the protesters related to that flip, or is it something else?
It is in some way directed to that flip, because the corruption that they are protesting against is basically about ministries that are stuffed on a sectarian basis with people doing funny things to the economy. And the protesters are saying there's a lot of money that is being siphoned off or misused at a time when we cannot afford food, we cannot afford fuel, we cannot afford education, we cannot afford housing and so on. So a large part of it is about socioeconomic grievances. But another large portion of it is about politics. Protesters saying we no longer want the Iraqi state to be run on the basis of sectarian politics.
So before we move on to Egypt, this new election law, would that be enough of a concession for protesters, whatever it would do? I mean, Iran has allegedly stepped in to prevent the ouster of Iraq's prime minister. So would this law be enough to satisfy the protesters?
Well, we're already hearing from protesters that it's not. They want the government gone. And, you know, these protests, as we've seen elsewhere, they start with something very small and then they snowball. And many Iraqis are now demanding a change to the entire system, not just the election law, not just the prime minister. They want the whole system, as I said, that was erected in 2003 on sectarian politics. They want that to be changed. And then you have Iran and you have the United States. These are the two major powers in Iraq. Will they consent to that change? That's a big, big, big question.
Let's talk Egypt, because the security forces there have expanded the crackdowns. Amid protests there, they've targeted journalists, foreigners, even children. The demonstrations broke out in late September. About 4,000 people have been arrested. Now, human rights activists say that this is the biggest crackdown to take place under the regime of Egypt's current president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Jennifer, targeting journalists, foreigners, children, What's up with this crackdown? I mean, has it gotten the government what it's wanted through this crackdown?
So here's what you have to understand about Egypt. When you had, you know, Mubarak fall, Hosni Mubarak, during the Arab Spring, that really kicked off something that you see a lot of times in post-revolutionary countries, which is that once the people have seen that a leader can fall, it's a lot easier to see that the next leader can fall, and the next, which means that, you know, Sisi, who took over from Mohamed Morsi in basically a military coup. Mohamed Morsi had been democratically elected, was the first democratically elected president after the fall of Mubarak. Sisi then takes over in a military coup and has been basically the dictator ever since. What you have to do to stay in power is to crack down harder and harder and harder, because the people have seen that, you know, that the kings can fall, right? And so, you know, Egypt has a long history going back, you know, decades and decades, and I would argue probably millennia, actually, of protesting against leaders and toppling leaders. But, you know, Mubarak was in power for a very long time through repression, but he also had the backing of the United States very robustly through counterterrorism. Sisi has tried to essentially follow that same model. He's just somehow more ruthless. I think if you had asked any Egyptian or Egyptian, you know, Egypt watcher during the Mubarak era that, you know, to imagine a more repressive government than Mubarak, they would have been hard pressed to even fathom that. And yet here we are.
And then Mohamed Morsi and then Abdel Fattah al-Sisi.
Right. So right. Mohamed Morsi, you know, basically did a not great job politically and economically and was kind of disliked by pretty much everyone. He wasn't even really supposed to be the Muslim Brotherhood's candidate. He was known as the spare tire. So
he kind of lasted like a year.
Yeah, exactly. So he was kind of ousted. And then Sisi, the strong man, comes in, and he's very much ruling under the model of the Mubarak, of the kind of strong man that we've seen not just across the Arab world, but across the world in general, right? There's a dictator's playbook, and that is crackdown, crackdown, crackdown. Do not allow dissent. You know, you can allow pockets of dissent in certain ways, right? The dissent that helps you, so you can have your regime protesters come out, because that's super helpful. But cracking down, I mean, we've seen students rounded up, university students, where previously university students used to be actually the most people allowed to protest in Egypt. So the crackdown is just harder and wider, and that's because you have to do that to maintain control.
One more story out of the Middle East we should touch on, Abdurrahim, and that's in Lebanon. There have been civilian-led protests for just under 2 weeks, and its Prime Minister Saad Hariri resigned on Tuesday. He had been in charge for less than a year. And during his resignation speech, Hariri said, quote, "Today I will not hide it from you. I have reached a dead end. It is time for us to have a big shock to face the crisis," unquote. What does Hariri's resignation mean for Lebanon, and are protesters looking forward to a replacement? What does this mean going forward?
Well, first of all, just as Fernando described the situation in Chile, this originally started off by protests about a 5-cent increase that the government wanted, or tax that the government wanted to impose on the use of WhatsApp. And then it basically snowballed into something very major, very political. Hariri is gone. It's hard to see a new government in Lebanon, despite what the protesters are saying, which does not have Hariri in one capacity or another, because Hariri is Lebanon's bridge to the West. He's Lebanon's bridge to Western money flowing into Lebanon. But the fact that he's resigned, he resigned against the advice of Hezbollah. Hezbollah was not obviously very pleased about that. That now raises the issue of where does Hezbollah go with Lebanon? Where do the protesters go with Hezbollah? Knowing obviously that Hezbollah is a strong supporter of or an ally of Iran, which has a big stake in Lebanon. Hariri was a big ally of Saudi Arabia, which had a big stake in Lebanon. The French have a big stake in Lebanon. It's a tiny country.
Yeah.
There are a lot of proxies. It's amazing, interesting politics.
There's a new FCC regulation that affects all NPR stations nationwide that says that every Friday we have to talk about Brexit. So we're going to do that. that now. Because on Tuesday, Boris Johnson, the prime minister, won the backing of Britain's parliament to hold a general election a few weeks before Christmas. The prime minister decided it's time to put the power back in the hands of the British people, which further bedevils the issue of how or if they can leave the EU. Here is Boris Johnson grappling with a tricky metaphor regarding a turkey.
We've got an oven-ready deal. Put it in the microwave. If you vote for us and we get our program through, which we will, because as I say, it's oven-ready, it's there to go, then we can be out at the absolute latest by January next year.
But many commentators have been quick to point out how badly his main opponent is polling. It's Jeremy Corbyn of the Labour Party. Here he is at his party's campaign launch with a message that sounds a lot like what you'd hear from Bernie Sanders.
We are going after the tax dodgers. We're going after the dodgy landlords. We're going after the bad bosses. We're going after the big polluters. Because we know whose side we, the Labour Party, are on.
Now, this week, Halloween was supposed to be the do-or-die deadline for Brexit. The president of the European Council, Donald Tusk, tweeted out that the extension has been granted, but he tweeted, quote, "It may be the last one. Please make the best use of this time. I will keep my fingers crossed for you," unquote. Jennifer, I think some people's fingers going to break because they've been waiting for a while. Yep. You can't cross your fingers for months and months and not have some arthritic, I don't know how this is going to work. This is not moving.
I think people's fingers are going to be making some different shapes pretty soon towards the government.
There's going to be some. Yes.
You feel me? Okay.
Yeah, I do. I see it. Yeah.
So what's going on here, basically? Now, with these elections, it does seem like this kind of crazy, oh, dear God, what now in Brexit? But this actually potentially could be the only way to break this deadlock that has been what has actually caused Brexit to be, you know, drawn out over, you know, well over a year for all these months of negotiations. And that fundamental deadlock is that, you know, the Parliament, who is in charge of, you know, agreeing to the deal and implementing the legislation that actually takes the deal and puts it into UK law, which is an entire other step, you know, they have themselves been deadlocked. You know, British politics has been fractured in very strange ways. It's made very odd bedfellows. Even, you know, the Tories, the Conservative Party, is kind of divided amongst itself between the hardcore Brexiteers and, you know, the less enthusiastic Brexiters. And so the idea and you know, the Prime Minister's kind of reasoning behind having this these elections is to basically say, look, okay, we're not going to have a second Brexit referendum, but this is kind of going to be that, right? We're not going to officially say, you know, Brexit, yes or no, but that's what this will be. So if you still want Brexit, everyone, come out, vote for a lot of conservatives who are pro-Brexit, put them in parliament. That way I, Boris Johnson, can have a majority. I can actually get done Brexit and we can move on.
Now, it's worth noting that the last prime minister who said, okay, vote, and if I lose, I'm out of here, was David Cameron from the same party, and they voted and he's like, let me find some cardboard boxes for my stuff.
Right. Yeah. So there's a history of things not going as well as people
thought.
Every
prime minister who's had to deal with Brexit has been decapitated by it, basically.
Right. Absolutely. I think, you know, part of the problem is, again, like you said, with Jeremy Corbyn, you know, mentioning that he sounds like Bernie Sanders, he is an avowed socialist. That is, you know, his political leaning as self-described. But he's wildly unpopular with most of his party and most people. He has, you know, major problems with anti-Semitism. He's got a lot of issues. And so it's kind of like, well, who do we vote for? You've seen the rise of the Lib Dems, who have become the kind of anti-Brexit party.
The Liberal Democrats.
Right, the Liberal Democrats, sorry. And so you've seen these kind of weird kind of changes in the British political system, but I think an election may be the only way to actually get some sort of resolution.
We should also talk briefly about China and Hong Kong before we go, because the pro-democracy protests have clearly taken a toll. The territory is now in a recession. Its economy shrunk just over 3% during the last quarter. Ferdinando mentioned the big trade summit being canceled due to the protests in Chile, the APEC summit, and part of that was supposed to involve trade talks between China and the U.S. So where does this leave those talks? Is that still a possibility, Fernando?
Yeah, that is still a possibility. I mean, when Donald Trump said insistently over the last few weeks that he was going to Chile, that the real important thing for him was this signing what they call the phase one of this U.S.-China trade deal. But U.S. sources are saying that it's still possible, maybe to find another place, maybe in mid-December, because that is the certain deadline for this. But remember, this has been a little bit complicated because the U.S. House of Representatives passed a resolution supporting the protests in Hong Kong.
One last story, a few warm words about the fate of endangered species. The population of mountain gorillas is rising in Rwanda. It was under 700 a decade ago. It's just over 1,000 today. And tourist dollars are actually helping. Groups are paying good money to see them in their natural habitats. The gorillas can be found in a number of places, including the mist-covered dormant volcanoes in Rwanda, Uganda, and Congo. George Schaller is a biologist and gorilla expert. He told the Associated Press that their population is still vulnerable, but their numbers are growing in remarkable ways. Clearly, it's been a busy week around the world. We've met our FCC requirement, as we will probably do every week and for the rest of the year. And I thank Jennifer Williams, foreign editor for Vox and co-host of Vox's foreign affairs podcast, Worldly. Jennifer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Fernando Pizarro, the Washington correspondent for Univision. Fernando, always a pleasure.
Thank you.
And Abdurrahim Fukara, the Washington bureau chief for Al Jazeera. Thank you, Abdurrahim.
Thank you kindly.
1A's senior team is Paige Osborne and Danielle Knight. Rupert Allman is our executive producer, and our podcast editor is Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about our team, you can visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.